Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Yo, turn this motherfucking shit up.
That grows natural, like locks on Africans, holding the smoke from the herb in my eyes.
selling mad crack or rapping. Peter Tosh tried to tell us what happened. He was saying if you black, then you African. So they had to kill him and make him a villain, cause he was teaching the children. I feel him, Dunn was trying to drop us a real gem. That's why we bucking holes in the ceiling when we hearing I'm an African. I'm an African.
Now, we're speaking with Brother Tupac Shakur, who was the national chairman of the New African Panthers. My name is Bomani Bakari. The program is indeed Round Midnight. Now, we all have African names, and so many brothers and sisters have yet to progress to that level. They may not understand that where they got their slave name from in the first place. Again, how important is it to embrace an African name? I'm a late arrival, I must confess. Perhaps your parents gave you an African name at birth. Is that not correct?
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Now, how important, how difficult was that for you, being raised in the African-American community with an African name when a lot of your friends are walking around with Barrys and Joes and Susans and everything?
I believe that the New African Panthers are about serious freedom, really reaching out and embracing serious freedom. If you truly want serious freedom and serious liberation and you want to have self-determination, how can you do that with the name that somebody else gave you? You know what I'm saying? The name from a person who didn't even respect you, you know? So when my mother gave me Tupac, I felt as though she literally liberated me at birth, cut the ties off me at birth and set me free, you know, set me on the path to righteousness. And with Tupac, growing up with that name, you know, when I was a kid, I did stupid stuff. You know, what's your name, Joe? I didn't want that bright star within me, you know. But now I embrace it because it gives you character, you know. Every time I say, what is your name, Tupac? I have to say, what does it mean? You know what I'm saying? Why does that name? And it's good. It gives me a chance to express myself and express what I'm about and what I'm going to do. With a name like Joe, who cares what it means? You know what I'm saying? It means nothing. Joe Schmo, you know what I'm saying?
So
what it does actually is liberate you and lets everybody know that you're breaking those chains that this whole society has put on you when you came here. They gave you a wrong religion, your wrong name, wrong, you know, switched everything around and put you in a society. So basically, I think that I'm not trying to put anybody down. And if your name is Joe, I'm sorry.
Or if it was Joe.
Yeah, if it was Joe. But on the strength, it should shock you. It should make you feel depressed. And it should make you feel bad inside walking around with some other person's name. You need to drop that and liberate yourself and really pick your name up. Because they told you your name was stupid when you came here. That's a dumb sounding name. You know what I'm saying? And so now you, okay, Joe, Jay, you know. So pick it up. You know what I'm saying? It's about that time. It's about that time. It's not all about just having an African name, because I met this sister, you know, she said, my name is, you know, Jody, but I want an African name, you know, because it's the end thing now to be positive. But don't just get an African name, get an African brain, you know what I'm saying? It's all about educating yourself first, you know. Don't walk around with that name if you can't defend the ideals and if you don't even know your culture, you know what I'm saying? So
exactly.
It's not all about just being, you know, Akinyele or Tupac or Yaki Caesar,
or Bomani,
you know,
or whatever, right?
It's all about having the brain to back up the name.
And also, we could extend that to the wearing now of African. Yeah, you know, and a lot of brothers don't even, my own son, and I can't even, you know, throw stones without letting him come home. He wanted one, and I say, son, can you name me 10 countries? He couldn't. So he didn't get one until he at least named me 10.
Right.
out of the 26
right.
that exist. So it's important, again, that we know and recognize who we are as Africans right. before we, again, can embrace that whole philosophy. But that's a good point, and it's well taken, hopefully, by a lot of brothers and sisters out there who are still walking around with the slave master's name and refuse to give it up for one reason or another. And I guess that brings me to my whole point about throwing off the shackles of Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
As young brothers, how have you managed to do that? I mean, you see, the society has said that you all are crackheads, that you all are baby makers, that you all are criminals and felons and gang banging and wilding and whatever part of the country that we find our brothers and sisters in, there's a negative connotation. Again, you yourselves personally, what's inside of you that makes you walk away from stuff that your peers perhaps are into on a daily basis that you may know?
Well, all praise due to Allah. He gave my mother the foresight of, you know, what this country would give to me and try to instill within me. So she gave me much history from starting from birth. And so I was raised knowing that I came from a great culture and a great people. And I was raised loving, you know, my people and knowing that we was meant to do more than stay high and get by. So it wasn't like, I mean, it was never no doubt. It was never any doubt in my mind whether or not, you know, I came from a great race and whether, I mean, there was no comparison with the pale, you know. So getting by is hard. You know, I'm not going to lie to you, you know, going through the streets. Every time, you know, because a cop will stop you. They stop. If you're black and you're walking and, you know, you get stopped. So they always stop us. You know, they'll question my friends, what's your name? My name is, you know, Anthony. My name is Father. And I had to go, oh, my God. What's your name?
Tupac
Amaru Shakur. And they go, and where's the ID? What are you doing here? Extra special harassment for me. Because they know I'm not getting high, you know. They know. And that's why I want my new African brothers and sisters to know that. Because if you have that name, if you have that brain and that idea, they know that you positive. They know that they should fear you. They should be scared of you. So that's what it's all about, basically, is breaking those chains. It's going to be hard. I'm not going to lie. It's going to be hard. But it was hard for those before us, you know, and they did it. People made great sacrifices for us to get this far, but not for us to be weary and not for us to be scared. You know, talking about it's okay now. Everything's fine. What are you talking about? It's over. You know, it's time for us to really get with it.
My name is Sam Hart, and I'm the Director General of the Abia State Marketing and Quality Management Agency. At the onset of the global COVID-19 pandemic, the Governor of Abia State, Dr. Okezie Victor Ekpeazu, gave a charge to our Abia tailors and artisans to rise up and meet the global shortage in face masks and other PPEs. I am proud to announce to you that Abia tailors and artisans have been able to produce over 1 million face masks, which has been distributed around Nigeria. ABA has the capacity to bridge the global shortage in PPE, nose masks, and other medical essentials, and we are here for you. You can reach us on phone number 0817-777-1306.
Hello everyone, welcome to today's episode of The Osasa Show. In today's program, we have the former African Union representative to the United States, Ambassador Arikana Chihombori Kwao. She will be speaking to us about how Africa can reposition itself post-COVID-19. Don't go anywhere, it promises to be a very enlightening interview. Welcome back to the Osasa Show. Joining me now is Her Excellency Ambassador Arikana Chihombori Kwao. Welcome to today's program, Your Excellency.
Thank you for having me, my dear.
You're most welcome. First of all, I must commend you and thank you for the relentless effort you have put in speaking for Africans world over. You popularly spoke about the French continuous colonization of African countries, particularly in West and Central Africa. This led to the stopping of the CFA franc being used in most of these countries. In December of 2019, these eight countries adopted the ECO currency. However, critics have still claimed that France still has its tutelage on these African countries because the ECO is still backed by the euro, and France is also making sure that they are also the people standing in for the currency. What do you have to say about that?
Well, what I can say is thank you for having me, my dear doctor. I appreciate all the work that you're doing to continue the conversation. Really, we're at a critical time in the history of Africa, and it is your world. You, the young, the youth of Africa, this is your world. Our job as your elders, we know we have messed up this Africa for you, but we would like to fix it and make it right. If we can't finish the job, at least when we leave this earth, we want to be able to say to you children, this is what we have done. There was a problem in our village, and this is where you need to pick up. Going to the issue of the ECO with France, what is needed is complete separation. What President Macron is suggesting to have an ECO that is going to be pegged to the euro is totally unacceptable. To have an ECO that when leaders of the African countries want to trade, all the trades have got to go through the French Central Bank and then pass on whichever country is wishing to trade with those former French colonies. That is also unacceptable. What is needed is complete separation. African leaders are quite capable of handling their own affairs. African countries, especially ECOWAS, they are quite capable of handling their own currency. They are already having discussions. The heads of state are having their own discussions. They have set up their own parameters as to what it's going to take for them to be ready to have their own single West African currency. France just needs to stop interfering. This is a program for the African heads of state in in West Africa. So for France to run in and think they can just steal the program away from the African heads of state, it's not going to happen. Ghana has already let them know. Nigeria has already let them know. So this is not going to happen. They can try to play games again, but we need to let President Macron know that we're not stupid. We know exactly what game he's playing. It's not going to work. The youth of Africa, the children of Africa, we may have been asleep for far too long, but President Macron needs to know once and for all that the children of Africa are waking up. Enough is enough. The games that they have played with us over the centuries, those games are over. They need to realize that this is a new game. They need to strategize because the Africans are not going to take it anymore. So those games of trying to put in this puppet euro, renamed ECO, is not going to work.
Ambassador, should we at least pat ourselves on the back? The fact that you clearly advocated that the representative of France sitting on the board of the West African Central Bank should be removed, and that representative was removed. Should we at least pat ourselves on the back for the fact that you also advocated that their currency, this CFA, should be changed, and it was changed? Should we pat ourselves on the back for this achievement, or is there still so much more that we need to fight for?
No, we are not ready to pat ourselves on the back yet. A lot more work is yet to be done. You got to understand that France is going to be a tough nut to crack. Uprooting France out of Africa, period, is going to be a tall order. Let's make no mistake about that. For France, getting out of Africa is a do or die. For them, without Africa, France is a worse than a third world country. So we know that. What is needed from France is to treat Africa fairly. Come to the table and treat the Africans fairly. Africa is a huge continent. Africa could feed all of China, all of India, all of Europe. We could even house the citizens of those countries. That's how humongous and that's how rich the African continent is. We are simply asking that those who engage Africa from outside Africa come to Africa with your suitcases chock full of humility, honor, and respect for the Africans. We will roll out the red carpet for you. But continued exploitation of the continent is no longer going to be tolerated. And for those who have gotten away with it for centuries, we want to send a message that is loud and clear that enough is enough. The game is over. Come to Africa and treat the Africans fairly. All we are asking is that they treat Africa and her children fairly, with respect, and do what is right and do what is just. Do what you would want done for your own children in Europe or wherever you are coming from. The little girls and the little boys in France, whatever their needs are also the needs of the little girls and little boys in Africa. We are not going to sit around anymore and watch our children starving to death. We are not going to sit around anymore and watch our women die while giving birth to another life. That time is over now. We can no longer play politics. We can no longer play diplomacy. How do we have a diplomatic conversation with a master who has never left? We are under the table while the master is sitting on the table in our house, eating our food that we would have served him. And then from under the table, the master is dictating that we should have a diplomatic conversation while he is on the table and we are under the table. That is not a conversation that can be diplomatic. In fact, we should be beating up France. We should have been beating up France a long time ago. And yet we're still under the table and begging for them to drop a few crumbs. And while we are under the table, they're telling us how we should organize ourselves in order to divide the few crumbs. No, France needs to know once and for all that what needs to happen is that France needs to come to the table as an equal partner. We are more than happy to negotiate with France as an equal partner. And France must understand Africa is big enough. There's enough for all of us. There's no need for the French companies to be so greedy. There's no need for France to be so greedy. Africa is big enough, and our hearts as Africans are big enough that we are ready to welcome the world. But they must come to Africa with respect for the Africans, just like we go to their countries with respect for their people. We are not asking them for anything that they would not ask of us when we come to their countries.
Exactly,
we are demanding respect.
Yes.
You come to Africa, you better respect the Africans.
Most
and
definitely.
That is all we are asking.
Yes, permit me to interject. I think one of the most shocking data that you released during one of your conversations was the fact that 50% of the reserves in these West African countries were domiciled in France. But during this recent meeting with the heads of state and President Macron, he said that that would no longer happen, that all the money in the West African and Central African central banks will remain as is. Is that enough, or is there more we need to do in preserving Africa's wealth for Africans in particular?
Well, what I would like to see is the action speaks louder than words. He made that proclamation. I have not heard anything yet that is saying the heads of state are no longer required to deposit their reserves with the Central Bank of France. So if you have more information on that, please enlighten me. It's one thing to make that proclamation, it's another thing to actually actualize it. Until I see it in writing, until I know that the heads of state are no longer depositing their finances, their financial reserves with France, it's just words coming from President Macron. We must actualize his words.
We cannot overemphasize the importance of good leadership. Because women like yourself held this sensitive position of African Union's permanent representative to the U.S., you use this platform to shine light on critical issues such as this. The world, even those of us living here in Africa, on the continent, in Nigeria, did not know this was going on in our neighboring countries. But you used your position to shine light on this very sensitive issue. So you can definitely agree with me that leadership is very important. What can African leaders do at this point, given the global pandemic, the COVID-19 has affected economies, it's affected the way we interact socially. What can African leaders do now to reposition itself from a place of strength, from a place of power, to ensure that our continent thrives once and for all, and we don't just pay lip service to the fact that yes, we're rich in natural resources, yes, we're a blessed continent, but we start to exemplify these blessings given to us.
Well, first of all, I'm constantly reminding everybody to go back to the Berlin Conference. If we understand why they met in Berlin, it's easy to understand where Africa is today. If we understand what happened in 1884, from November 1884 to February of 1885, we will understand why we are today. If we also understand what took place during those 4 months, it will also disgust us to say 136 years later, a strategy that was put in place to keep us forever defeated and dominated remains in place today. And we actually seem to have completely forgotten about it. We have normalized it. We have accepted it. Berlin Conference intentionally broke us up into the tiny little economies that cannot survive on their own. Let me reiterate what I've always said. How can Togo negotiate with the European Union? How does Djibouti negotiate with China? How does Central African Republic negotiate with the United States? We must learn something from the United States. United States understood that as Delaware, the state of Delaware, cannot survive, as the state of Illinois alone cannot survive, California, even California and Texas, the biggest states in the United States, they knew their strength was in the numbers and in their unity. So they came together and created the United States of America. Africa should be a continent that needs to grow up to be like the United States. We must come together and be the Africa that we were before the Berlin Conference. Berlin Conference was a strategy designed to see to it that we will forever be chasing our tails as tiny little economies. We must come together. That is why our Pan-African fathers met in 1963, precisely to put together, to rebuild that which was destroyed by the colonizers, by breaking us up during the Berlin Conference. Sadly, they did not succeed. It took us 56 years since 1963 to finally come up with what we're now calling the African Continental Free Trade Area, which was signed in 2018 by the African heads of state. Implementation of that decision was supposed to be in July. Thanks to COVID, it's been pushed back to January. When we come together as Africa, when we go to the negotiating table, as Africa, the continent, we are a powerhouse. We are a heavyweight. And we belong on the world stage with other heavyweight boxers. But to honestly think that Togo can go to the world market as Togo, that is ridiculous, it is laughable, and it is unbelievable that for 135 years we have allowed this stupidity to go on. How does Djibouti go to the world stage and claim sovereignty, standing next to the United States, standing next to China, standing next to the European Union, standing next to India? Djibouti is going to be swallowed. It is just that simple. And we Africans sit back and complain about why Djibouti is not doing this, why Togo is not doing this, why Malawi is not doing this. These are little boys being forced, being thrown in the heavyweight boxing ring every day. Let's understand our Africa from the root. Let's not be forced to complain about the leaves of this tree and the flowers of this tree, which are going to come and go one season after the other, and completely disregard the root causes of why Africa is where it is today. So to answer your question, what Africa needs is unity, is an Africa speaking with one voice. None of the former French colonies can fight France on their own. It's only when they come together as West Africa, when Africans come together as Central Africa, but even better, when we come together as the continent, can we take a position and push back in a manner that we can actually succeed. Now, I have to say, my young daughter, that time is around the corner. Because the African youth are waking up. The Africans are saying enough is enough. We've been asleep for far too long. We are waking up from our slumber of centuries. Yes, granted, we were systematically put there. We were systematically brainwashed. But the game is up, and the Western world, and now the Eastern world, they must also wake up and smell the coffee. That they can no longer continue this game with the old rules. It is a new game that is calling for new rules of engagement. We are open. We are Africans. We have a huge heart. This is who we are, and we are ready to accommodate anybody that's going to come to us with respect. That is all we are asking. We are asking that they respect us. We are asking that they treat us fairly. These unfair trade policies can no longer be tolerated. So my hope is, come January next year, we can officially implement the African Continental Free Trade Area. So our Africa, united, can go to the world stage as one customs union. Now we are talking of a superpower. Now we are talking of a powerhouse. United, nobody can mess with us. So that is the answer. That is the solution to Africa's problems. But to try and deal with these issues on a national level, it's never going to work. We are forever going to be chasing our tails, which is precisely where they want us to be. And they have succeeded. So to those who contrived the Berlin Conference, I say to you from your grave, wherever you are, congratulations. Job well done. 135 years later, the children of Africa are still chasing. We are still chasing our tails.
Ambassador Aritana, understanding the root cause to any problem is one step towards fixing it. So I thank you so much for clearly elucidating and explaining the root cause of Africa's problems. But would you also consider the lack of capable leadership as an endemic issue across Africa? We talk about the issue of corruption across African leaders. We talk about the issue of ineptitude, the issue of basic education for most of these leaders. You hear the conversations that most of these leaders have and you wonder, are they even educated enough to hold this position of power? So what is the solution, homegrown solutions that we as Africans can prepare to pick the right leaders? Because we see a lot of thugging and violence during the elections, and anybody who has the money, the financial capacity, just assumes that power of leadership without having the requisite knowledge and self-composure to actually attain that level of power. So what can we do as Africans, African youths, people passionate about this continent, to elect the right leaders? We understand that the root cause has been decided over 135 years ago, but what can we do as a people to change the course of things to ensure that we have capable men and women at the helm of affairs to lead this continent forward?
Let me give you an example, my daughter, of you and I on a journey and a few of your friends. And we are lost in the forest. And in our way, in our efforts to go home, we pick up the wrong lane. Instead of going east, we are going west. It doesn't matter how much strategizing we do. We are on a losing path. We are not going home. Until we find our way and turn around and be on the right path going east, that is the only way we are going to go home. Through the Berlin Conference, and through the policies they put in place when we got our independence in the late 50s and early 60s, where they intentionally kept the economic liberation from us, gave us limited political liberation. And I'm saying limited because they still continue to control the politics of the land through their various conniving means. We are not in control of our destiny. It's like you and I, my daughter, like I said, we're trying to go home. We are lost in the forest. We are going west when we should be going east. First and foremost, Africa must be on the right path. You can win all the fights you want to win. If you are on a losing path, you are still going down. You can win all the fights you want. You're going riding in a derailing train. You're still going to go down. What Africa needs, I am not saying we do not have problems with corruption. Don't get me wrong. Corruption is a serious problem and we must address it vigorously. However, when I look at the issues of leadership, if I were to simplify the conversation and say, let's talk about our issues as from scale of 1 to 10, I would put leadership around 5, 6. Why? Until France can leave the $500 billion on the continent, until all the other colonizers can stop extracting all these minerals out of Africa to the tune of billions, until illicit funds are stopped from getting out of Africa, until the looting of the illegal mining, the trade in plants and wildlife, all these illegal activities that are taking out of Africa trillions of dollars combined, they want us to not talk about it. And another big one are those safe havens from all the multinationals who are working in Africa. They have existed, majority of them, even prior to independence. They do not pay taxes. The average African on the street is paying taxes. These multinational corporations are not paying taxes using these safe havens. Again, billions of dollars are getting out of Africa. Allow me to put things in perspective. When you put all this corruption from outside together, you are talking trillions of dollars getting out of Africa that we are being told not to talk about. They have done a great job at making sure that the Africans don't understand the intricacies of what they are doing, the game that they are playing. All they want us to force us to believe is that corruption is your only problem, that leadership is your only problem. No, on a scale of 1 to 10, yes, leadership is an issue. In some cases, not all. Let me make that clear. Let's not paint Africa with one blanket, one brush. No, there are many African heads of states who are doing very well for their people. We cannot just blame it all on corruption. All of Africa is corrupt. That is wrong, and we must refuse it and deny it and call it out. If you want to talk about a corrupt situation in a particular country, then talk about that particular situation. But don't take that one particular situation and extrapolate it throughout the continent. That is wrong, and we will not accept it.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Rikana Chihombori-Kwau, for your time. I truly appreciate it. Women like yourself are an inspiration to young people across the continent like me who look up to you, your boldness, your eloquence, and your passion for the African continent. Thank you so much for your time. That's it for today's program. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Ask yourself a show.
As follows. She, Marcel Jaber, used the famous Gazelle test for early intelligence developed at Yale University's Child Development Center. The pictures of the 48-hour child, two-day-old child, supported only by the forearms, both upright, perfect head balance and eye focus, and a marvelous intelligence shining in the face, are no more astonishing than those of the six-week-old child. Get what we're saying here again, that the characteristics of these black children at 2 days old, at 6 or 7 weeks, these children crawled skillfully, could sit up by themselves, would sit spellbound before a mirror looking at their own images for long periods. This particular ability was not expected in the American European child before 24 weeks, that is 6 months, according to the Gazelle test. So here again, we're looking at an intellectual and psychomotor development occurring in African children some 6, 7, 8 weeks ahead of those of Europeans. Between 6 and 7 months, the Ugandan children performed the toy box retrieval test. Javert showed the infant a toy, walked across the room, put the toy in a tall box. The child leaped up, ran across the room, and retrieved the toy. Besides the sensory motor skills of walking and retrieval, the test shows that object constancy has taken place, the first great shift of logical processing in the brain, at which point an object out of sight is no longer out of mind, the characteristic of infancy and early childhood. This test, successfully completed by the Ugandan children between 6 and 7 months of age, was not to be expected until somewhere between the 15th and 18th month in American and European children. There is no substitute for self-knowledge. We cannot let even the palliative statements of multiculturalism, which seeks to equate children all across cultures, blind us to our own possibilities as people. We must not let our fear of inferiority make us latch on to the idea that children are only different in their color of their skin. These kind of mythologies prevent us from knowing ourselves and from appropriately dealing with our children in terms of their development and in terms of their possibilities. This kind of study has been duplicated time and time again, not only in Africa, but in the United States and in other parts of this world. And as a number of you might know, they appear to be, the findings of these kind of studies in part appear to be connected to the melanin base of our bodies as African people. On some level, they may appear to reflect what we call in biology a theory of recapitulation, in that during the developmental sequences of the human embryo, we go through earlier evolutionary sequences. We also, in our development as an ethnic group and as a people, repeat on a certain level in our early development the developmental histories of our people. And perhaps as we see our children walking first and talking first and negotiating reality first, intellectually processing the information of this world in advance of white children and others, we may on this level may see repeated the history of African people, the first man on this earth, the first man to walk this earth, the first man to intellectually master this earth and to deal with it in terms of intellectuality and in terms of definite control and power. Let's take one other look at another study here of some Kikuyu infants. On both the mental and motor tests, the Kikuyu infants were precocious, scoring significantly higher than would be expected for American infants of the same ages. As compared with the standard score of 100 American infants average on these tests, the average Kikuyu mental score was 108 and their average motor score 129. The Kikuyu infants bettered the standard score on 38 mental items and on 20 motor test items. They were lower than the standard on 7 of the mental test items and 2 of the motor test items. However, the researchers were under the impression that these items involved implements that are familiar to American infants but not familiar to Kikuyus. When Kikuyu infant test scores month by month were compared month by month with month by month scores for white infants in the United States and the United Kingdom, the Kikuyu infants performed better on both mental and motor tests throughout the 15-month period of observation than did any of these other groups. However, the superiority of their performance tapered off somewhat towards the end of that period of the period. A number of reports have suggested that sub-equatorial African infants are precocious in their motor development and possibly also in their mental development, and this study appears to confirm these reports. We'll be back to this so-called tapering off momentarily. Jibera concluded as a result of her studies that the precocity of these African children was not only in motor development, it was found in intellectual development also. It is not always realized that intellectual development is displayed very clearly in the use of the gazelle material. To take an elementary example, The child who merely looks at the cubes and then picks them up is demonstrating a series of intellectual processes. And for the building of a tower with the cubes, more complex processes are needed, in addition to the greater manual dexterity. Although most of the African children had never seen anything resembling the test material, they used it in the same way as European children had succeeded in the test earlier than those children. Their interest was lively and their personal social relations excellent. They made good contact with the tester, turning and talking, smiling, and trying in every way to communicate.
Welcome to the Great African Leadership Series, where we feature great inspirational speeches and quotes from African leaders.
Fellow freedom fighters, comrades and friends, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Accra and to this conference of African freedom fighters and supporters of the growing movement for Africa's liberation and unity. It is good for our cause to have a periodic meeting of this kind to examine our position in the great struggle to rid Africa completely and forever of imperialism and its handmaidens, colonialism and neocolonialism. Africa is rich and not poor. As the great wealth that has been taken out of our continent over five centuries of despoliation and extortion, very well proved. Africa has immense actual and potential wealth. Gold, diamond, copper, manganese, bauxite, iron ore, uranium, asbestos, chrome, cobalt, a host of other minerals. Our essential agricultural produce have all been drained away by colonialist imperialism. Africa is far from being poor. It is Africans who are poor, not Africa. And they are poor because of the uncounted profit that has been made out of the exploitation of their labor and their lands. If we are being bidded to enter a European community, we must have something that community needs, and needs badly, when it pretends to offer a bonus by way of aid. When Greeks come bearing grapes, should we not look them well in the mouth, if I may mix my metaphor? But I'm sure you get my meaning. I raise this point so that it will stay in your mind when you may be tempted by the seductive promises of new colonialism to forget the real character of colonialist imperialism and be persuaded away from your own true interests and those of Africa. For today, we must each see ourselves as part of Africa in order that we may face colonialist imperialism and its new form, new colonialism, on a continent-wide front. For unity must be the keynote of our actions. Our enemies are many, and they stand ready to pounce upon and exploit our very weakness. They tell us that this particular person or that particular country has greater or more favorable potentialities than the other. They do not tell us that we should unite, that we are all as good as we are able to make ourselves once we are free. Remember, always, that you have four stages to make. First, the attainment of freedom and independence. Secondly, the consolidation of that freedom and independence. Thirdly, the creation of unity and community between the free African states. Fourth, the economic and social reconstruction of Africa. This requires some plain speaking. And for the sake of Africa, let us speak plainly. As I see, our greatest danger stems from disunity and the inability to see that the realization of our hopes and aspirations, the realization of our objective of total African independence and of our future progress and prosperity is inextricably bound up with the necessity to unify our policy and actions in connection with the continuous struggle for independence and the greater task of economic and social reconstruction beyond it. We must therefore face the issue of African unity now, for only unity will make the artificial boundaries and regional demarcations imposed by colonialism obsolete and superfluous. African unity will thus provide an effective remedy for border disputes and internecine troubles. In a united Africa, there could be no frontier claims between Ethiopia and Somalia, or between Zanzibar and Kenya, Guinea or Liberia, or between Ghana, Togoland and the Ivory Coast. Because we would regard ourselves as one great continental family of nations. Some of the leaders, it must be confessed, do not see the struggle of their brother Africans as part of their own struggle. Even if they did, they would not be free to express their solidarity. This rift are consciously created by the imperialists between Africans, where they can sit back and watch with sly satisfaction, as well as contempt for those who fail to see how they are being used against Africa's best interests. Regrettably, those states include some who were among the freedom fighters of yesterday and who haven't won their independence, are willing to drop it for some token aid and thereby deny to those still struggling for freedom even their moral support. Here is a phenomenon against which all African freedom fighters must be on their guard and resist to the utmost. Even though I appreciate the difficulties facing us, I must admit, I find it strange to watch some of us returning willingly to the colonialist fold. This time, they don't even have the excuse of being forced to subject themselves to foreign domination. It makes one wonder, why so much effort and sacrifice and so many lives were given up to the achievement of independence in the first place, if it can only be so quickly and easily surrendered. We must begin to build immediately our own continental common market. For it is easy for anyone who studies the common market organization closely to realize that the common market is aimed at harnessing the African countries to satisfy the profit loss of the imperialist bloc and to prevent us from following an independent neutralist policy. It is easy to see that the imperialists and the colonialists are determined to retain the African countries in the position of suppliers of cheap raw materials. If we do not resist this threat, and if we throw in our lot with the common market, we shall doom the economy of Africa to a state of perpetual subjection to the economy of Western Europe. This will, of course, hinder the industrialization of our young African states. It is impossible to think of economic development and national independence without possessing an unfettered capacity for maintaining a strong industrial power. The activities of the common market are therefore fraught with dangerous political and economic consequences for the independent African states. The organization constitutes an attempt to replace the old system of colonial exploitation by a new system of collective colonialism, which will be stronger and more dangerous than the old evils we are striving to liquidate from our continent. This is another reason why we should come together in a unified African economic plan, which, operating on a continental scale, can make a solid attack on the imperialist domination in Africa. We should, without delay, aim at the creation of a joint African military command. There is little wisdom in our present separate effort to build up and maintain defense forces, which, in any case, would be ineffective in a major world conflict. If we examine this problem realistically, we would ask, which single African state could protect itself against an imperialist aggressor? And how much more difficult this would be when some states are allowing the imperialists to maintain bases on their territories. I have already referred to the military forces with South Africa, its reason, and the danger it poses for the new African state and the struggle of those still in chains. Only our unity can provide us with anything like adequate protection. Those problems can best be met within a unified Africa, and it should be possible in the higher reaches of our endeavor to devise a constitutional structure which will secure the objectives I have outlined, and yet preserve the sovereignty of each of the countries joining the Union. Countries within the Union will naturally maintain their own constitutions, continue to use their own national emblems and national anthems and other symbols and paraphernalia of sovereignty. Regional associations and territorial groupings can only be other forms of balkanization unless they are conceived within the framework of a continental union. There are existing models which we can modify or adapt to our pattern. The United States of America, the Soviet Union, India and China have proved the efficacy of unions embracing large stretches of land and population. Long live African freedom fighters. Long live African independence. Long live your struggle. And long live African unity.
And share this video with friends and...
Pan-Africanism, what I'd like to do in the 20-minute period we have is to give you its general outline, its general development, and of course its future path. Some people think that Pan-Africanism is a response to colonialism. While certainly Pan-Africanism responded to colonialism, we must not think that it's colonialism that brought Pan-Africanism into being. Of course, to see this clearly, we should just look at the general evolutionary processes of all societies on a universal basis. All societies have a tendency to go from a smaller social aggregate to a larger social aggregate, from the family to the tribe to the clan to the nation to the continent. This is an evolutionary process. This theory can be seen in living practice if today we were to look at Europe. Europe everywhere speaks of European continental unity. Even though Europe has fought more fratricidal wars than any other continent or all the continents put together, Europe still speaks of European continental unity. Of course, Africa will unify before Europe, but that's not the point of discussion here this evening. The fact that Europe, with all the fratricidal wars she has fought, can speak of continental unity shows this evolutionary process. Africa, like any other society anywhere in the world, was involved in this same evolutionary process, going from family to tribe to clan to nation to continent. This evolutionary process was interrupted by European imperialism. It came in two forms, slavery and colonialism. First, they took over 300 million, the strongest, out of Africa, and then they divided Africa at the Berlin Conference. So you can see that Africa herself was moving on this evolutionary process. This evolutionary process, which would lead to continental unity, and Africa will still be the first continent unified, was interrupted by European capitalism. Since it was interrupted by European capitalism, an evolutionary process, the only way that Africa can unite today is through a revolutionary process aiming at a socialist economy. If capitalism destroyed us, it doesn't make sense to use capitalism to continue with it. We must use the antithesis of capitalism, which of course is socialism. And certainly if the evolutionary process has been interrupted, the only way we can capture the time lost is through a revolutionary process. We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people. So this, then, is the general outlines of Pan-Africanism. So you must not think that Africanism just began. Had Africa been left untrampled by European imperialism, we'd have a long time achieved continental unity. Secondly, Pan-Africanism must be seen as a movement, a mass movement. And this mass movement must be properly understood. Africa, of course, because of racism, is belittled everywhere. And many people do not see Africa's constant, underline the word constant, contributions to world civilization. Since the 1940s, Africa has given, even before the 1940s, actually we can go back to the Honorable Marcus Garvey, Africa has given to world political movements a mass character. Africans revolt in masses, never as a vanguard party. If you look at the independence struggle in Africa, it was nothing less than mass. If you look at the struggle in the Caribbean for independence, it was nothing less than mass. And even in the United States of America, the only movement they call a mass movement is our movement. Therefore, this mass character must be properly understood. Pan-Africanism has this mass character. Africans have this mass character in responding. And our responsibility is to bring this mass character together, make it precise, so that it can direct its blows at the enemy, hitting him, until we knock him down. Therefore, the task of Pan-Africanism is to gather the masses of our people together in the same organization, irrespective of where they find themselves, be it in Europe, be it in the United States, be it in the Caribbean, or be it in Africa. This is the first aspect, then, we must understand. Pan-Africanism found its organizational expression in 1900. Here, a Pan-African conference, here the word conference, was organized by Africans from all over the world. They came together deciding that something must be done for Africa. One of the leading organizers of this conference was a man by the name of Henry Sylvester Williams, born in Trinidad, a man whom you should do some history on, a very, very great man. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois attended the conference, but he was not one of the leaders in 1900. By 1917, 1918, the idea of a necessity for a Pan-African Congress, not conference, Congress, was to be called. But most of the people who did the conference were dead. Henry Sylvester Williams was dead. A lot of them were dead. Du Bois was about the only one who was alive. Du Bois recognized he had a historic responsibility to continue the work of Pan-Africanism, so he called the first Pan-African Congress. Make a clear distinction. The first one in 1900 was a conference. Du Bois, being intelligent, understanding that a conference is limited and a Congress has more elasticity and can go longer, called it a Pan-African Congress. From the 1990s up until 1945, we could say seriously, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois just about single-handedly kept the flame of Pan-Africanism alive. One thing must also be underlined to you. Pan-Africanism was brought into being in its organized form by the Africans outside of Africa. This was done only because of the oppression of Africa. At that time, Africa was under total colonial domination. There could be no political meetings. As a matter of fact, if you had the paper of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, you could go to jail. So the conditions were such that it was difficult for the Africans on the continent to organize. Africans off the continent, recognizing this, came quickly to fill up that gap. So Pan-Africanism itself was brought to bear by the diaspora. But you must not think that the diaspora brought Pan-Africanism for the diaspora. Not at all. The center of the discussions has always been Africa. This must be properly understood. Some people try to shift it, make it take it somewhere else, but Africa has always been the focus. Du Bois carried on his congresses up until the Fifth Congress in 1945. Because of time, we're just going through them quickly. In 1945, saw the Fifth Pan-African Congress. Here, you had Africans born on the continent, in the Caribbean, and Africans, of course, born in Europe and the United States. At this Fifth Pan-African Congress, there were three co-secretaries, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, George Padmore of Trinidad, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. So we had an African from the Caribbean, one from the United States, and one from the continent, who were co-secretaries of the Fifth Pan-African Congress. The Fifth Pan-African Congress is crucial for us. A decision was made there. They said that the final confrontation with colonialism is coming. After all, this is 1945, and you must know that there's negative and positives in everything. I remember once as a young man reading Mein Kampf on an airplane, sitting next to a woman. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean what I'm doing? I'm reading Mein Kampf." "Why are you reading it?" I said, "Well, Hitler's a very important man. He had historical effects on the world, you know." She said, "Well, I'm a Jew." I said, "Have you read it?" She said, "No." I said, "Oh, that's bad." I said, "Have you not read Sun Yat-sen?" She said, "No." I said, "He says the first law of war is to know the enemy. If I were a Jew, I would read everything there is to read on Hitler." Well, of course. Of course. So, while reading Hitler, she was arguing. I said, "Well, Hitler had some positive effect anyway." She said, "What positive effect did Hitler have?" I said, "Hitler weakened European imperialism. He weakened the British, he weakened the French, he weakened the Portuguese, he weakened the Belgians, and that's how we got independence." These are facts of life. When Hitler got through with Britain, when the Indians said they want independence, Britain could do anything but get out of the way and let them have independence. Matter of fact, they got Mahatma Gandhi quick because they didn't want to deal with the armed struggle that the Indians were preparing for British imperialism in India. And by the time India was free, well, it was over. China came up after China, of course, Africa throughout, etc., etc. And by 1960, in 15 short years of the declaration of the Fifth Pan-African Congress in 1945, two-thirds of the African continent was independent. You must understand clearly the importance of this. Now, at the Fifth Pan-African Congress, they said the only solution to the final confrontation is mass organization. And I say, if you look at Africans, we have nothing but mass character in our struggle. Of course, this mass character for the moment is spontaneous and must be transformed to something that is planned and permanent. But certainly the mass character is there. If you just look back to the Rodney King situation, those Africans who rebelled, rebelled en masse. They had no planning. That's how backward they were. They didn't think about it. Just on the spot, they said, "Okay, it's too much. Let's go. Let's get them." And everybody said, "Okay, let's get them." And we rise up as mass and we get them. And then we sit down for 29 years. Of course. But the mass character is there. And we must understand this mass character. The Fifth Pan-African Congress, most of Africa, of course, was colonized. Kwame Nkrumah came to change all this. By 1958, he threw the British out of Cape Coast and named it Ghana. And Nkrumah declared before the entire world that the independence of Ghana is meaningless unless it's linked with the entire continent of Africa and its unification and liberty. And Ghana and Nkrumah made Ghana the base for every movement that fought against colonialism. In our struggle since the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. It must be clear then, for the 60s,
The class struggle in the African Revolution must be more ruthless and uncompromising than in any other revolution. Here then, the masters must come without pity and without mercy to trample upon these reactionary pigs who, after the people have gained struggle through their blood, come to hand back the gains on a silver platter to the very enemy the people fought. This will come as a natural consequence. The people themselves are everywhere screaming that it's time for them to deal with these reactionary pigs. Even in America, they say, our leaders must be held accountable. They're only saying here that these people must be accountable to those who made it possible for them to get there. Thus, not only is the revolution inevitable, but it is clarifying itself, and it is qualifying itself. For the African masses everywhere, the clairvoyant position now for class struggle has become inevitable and irreversible. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we, who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we, who knowing that the people will always be free, we, understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. The organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. We're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you.
Texas. He got a great deal of his schooling in Denver, Colorado, where he got several certificates and diplomas, and then got a doctorate in education at the University of Denver. He lived and served as an educator in Liberia in West Africa. He was a dean at San Francisco State University, the institution of higher education that gave birth to the Black Studies phenomenon. Now, Dr. Hilliard lives in East Point, Georgia, and he works in Atlanta at the Georgia State University, where he is Calloway Professor of Education, which means that he's not only a tenured professor, but that he has something that very few of us have, and that's a chair, which is a very high rank in terms of faculty. Dr. Hilliard has published widely. He's been the author of several very important projects. He has written some very, very insightful appraisals of various aspects of education as it pertains to especially our young people. He has published two very, very important books, The Maroon Within Us and The Saber. He is known throughout the world as one of the most committed and dedicated African educators who has demonstrated his commitment to the correct socialization of our young people. He was a founding member, is a founding member of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, where he is the first vice president and the chairperson of the Education Commission. And outside of all of those very, very impressive formal credentials, Dr. Hilliard has the great talent for picking excellent family relationships. He was very insightful, and he married a sister who is now the mayor of the town they live in. And somehow or another, he was wise enough to get involved in a family that is connected with the Carruthers family, and therefore he's able to claim me as a cousin. But Ava Hilliard is a warrior. He's been on this battlefield. He has been a general that I've been very happy to follow and fight alongside, and it's good to have him there. He's a brother. He's a friend. And he is a master teacher. And so I will ask you to welcome our brother, Dr. Asa Grant Hilliard III. Hotel. I noticed that when Cousin Jake asked if there was anyone older than he was that could give him permission to speak, no hands went up. So I'm going to ask, since I'm 2 years younger than he is, or 2 years older. I need the permission of the elders to speak as well. Thank you. Also, would like to ask us to pause for a moment to acknowledge our Creator, who though hidden is the source of all life, power, and health. And acknowledge, as you already have, the ancestors, each and every one of them that you can remember, even those you can't remember, those ancient that made a name for themselves, those who picked cotton, who were plumbers, carpenters, may not have made a name for themselves, including those who may be like young brothers who I get letters from almost daily now, who are locked up, sometimes in solitary confinement. They're one of the million Africans in prison who are struggling to know themselves because they have the time to reflect sometimes and no time to do anything else. And I think about them a lot. And many of them have died, and they have now become ancestors out of the hellhole of America. And I hope that we remember them too, because all of them collectively have done things that would be beneficial if we keep their memories alive, and they will join us and bless our efforts in this struggle. I'm really always extremely happy to come to Chicago, and my other location is Detroit, because I think that those are like the left and right eye of the African world, that we have more mobilized African consciousness, in my opinion, in those two places than almost anywhere else in the whole country. And we are right at the center, the pupil of the eye as I stand here, the Chicago Center for Inner City Studies. And all you'd have to do is look at the track record of those educators who have worked here, those who helped begin this institution, Barbara Sizemore, Don Smith, and of course the incredible leadership of my cousin, Dr. Jay Carruthers, as measured by what has happened to the people who have left these parts, as they have put their imprint on things all across this nation. And so this indeed is the pupil of the eye of the African world here in Chicago. Jake mentioned my wife as the mayor of East Point. She is.
She also has a Chicago connection, which you may not know. Her great-great-grandfather was the last African to serve in the Illinois legislature. His name was J.W.E. Thomas. And he founded an independent African school in Chicago. And he was a philanthropist. He found some way to earn enough money to give it away. His family had come up from the South. His dad was a ship's captain on, I think it was the Mississippi River. And finding a better way, he came to these parts and made his mark. And it's my understanding that one day I need to go back and research what he did in the legislature, because I believe that he was heavy on civil rights legislation and education legislation. His daughter, Esther Archer, she married as an archer, went to New York and became the first woman to serve on a jury in New York. And then her son was the one who was the father for my father-in-law. And so I thank Chicago for my grandchildren, because without that story, there wouldn't have been the grandchildren that I have anyway. That's a convoluted way to tell a story, but that is a true story. The theme of this conference is a critical one. And I chose to speak to the theme of the conference, operationalizing Pan-Africanism. And the foundation for what I want to say has really been laid, and certainly in the sessions that I attended, the one on the Nubian archaeological find, the one on the whole history of that Ethiopian struggle, magnificent presentation. And of course, with Brother Runoko Rashidi, I just don't know what to say about him, because he's better than all the old wine in the world. The older, the better. He gets gooder and gooder. And of course, Brother Kobe Cambone, whose work is simply awesome, and we just need to take the time to understand what he's trying to say. And it's always consistent, it's always penetrating in terms of our mental illness. What's wrong with us, as he said. And how did we get in the mess that we're in? That's what Jake helps tell. But the purpose of this conference is to figure out how we get out of the mess that we're in. And so part of what I tried to do was to be a little bit reflective and to see if I could raise some issues, maybe in a slightly different way, maybe a fresh one here or there, that deals with this issue of operationalizing Pan-Africanism. Now, operationalizing means that we talk a lot. And the nationalist community is especially accused of that. They say, well, y'all have great conferences. Y'all write wonderful books, and you make good presentations, but you don't own banks. You don't have an army, that you're not mobilized. And they criticize us unfairly, I think, because there's a lot that is really extremely operative in what many people do. Garvey is a case in point. Was everything that they say nationalists are, but in addition to that, mobilize economically and politically, internationally, and there are a lot of people that are doing that now. But I think in part, the criticism is also justified, that we do have to do something else if we're going to operationalize Pan-Africanism. And even if we don't, for those who are maybe in the masses and not being reflective at the moment, because there's no such thing as a single small community that's going to operationalize anything that matters for the masses of the people. We have to get the masses of the people moving. We have to recapture the minds. We have to recapture the hearts of African people all over the world. And one of the beautiful things about Brother Runoko Rashidi's presentation was those little vignettes that he gave us about the consciousness awakening in places all the way around the globe, sometimes as a consequence of things that got started right here in Chicago, sometimes using language that wasn't invented where they are, but they're already tuned in to some of the things that would enable them to become the people that they need to be. And so I want to raise the question of what it would take for us to become mobilized, to become operational, and not merely to become ideological. You know, what keeps us from becoming operational? And I think it's really a question of some basics. And the very first basic thing that affects us, and I always struggle about how to say this, is that we have not the problem of ideology so much, not the problem of philosophy so much, but we have the problem of whether we can answer a single fundamental question. And that question is, do we belong to a family or are we by ourselves? That's fundamental. If you're by yourself, then of course there's no reason for a meeting like this. On the other hand, if you belong to a family, certain things flow from that. Certain things must happen if you truly are a member of a family. Now, my language for saying that has been that the fundamental question that we have to answer for ourselves is to be African or not to be. Because I don't believe that if we decide not to be African, that we can exist. I think that we will exist as individuals, but there's no place for you to go. You're not going to be British. I don't think they call you to the French meeting. The Chinese don't want you. The Japanese are full. And so if you decide not to be African, I don't know what else there is for you. And so the question, to be African or not to be, is one way of stating what I just said earlier, whether we're going to be members of a family or not and act like a family. That's the fundamental issue. And why is that fundamental issue, the fundamental issue? Because I believe that the masses of our people are confused about that issue. Very confused about that issue. Frightened about that issue. Embarrassed to identify with an African family. Even identify with themselves. If I were to read a little clip from an article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times. I've been collecting these. This comes from Nairobi, Kenya. I have an article like this from Barbados. I have an article like this from Jamaica. I have an article like what I'm getting ready to share with you from Ghana. I have one from Nigeria. And I have some from the United States. I have a little collection of articles about this. The TV ad couldn't be clearer. A young woman stares lovingly at her young man in a college cafeteria. Another pretty woman with a slightly lighter skin saunters by. And the young man teasingly asks his girlfriend how he can tell the woman that she is the most beautiful girl I have ever seen. His girlfriend is devastated. In chimes in this ad, a female voice advising her to use Fair and Lovely, a skin cream that has special fairness vitamins and is guaranteed to lighten the complexion in just 6 weeks. The woman uses the cream. Sure enough, she keeps her man. The advertisement aired on Kenyan television and assures women that skin cream will give them a fairness that lights up your life. The cream's manufacturers insist that Fair and Lovely is not a bleach, but the creams contain bleaching agents that promise to whiten, brighten the skin, and make women more attractive, and these are the rage in many African countries. From the West African powerhouse of Nigeria to South Africa, women and men too are using creams, lotions, sometimes capsules to get their skin fairer. Dermatologists warn that many of the creams and pills give false guarantees, and they say they are dangerous enough that they should be banned in Kenya as they were in Ghana, or I'm sorry, in Nigeria, and I think also in Ghana. They contain large amounts of hydroquinone and a white crystalline depigmenting agent that is safe in small concentrations but can be fatal in large doses. Symptoms of over-ingestion range from ringing in the ears to nausea, shortness of breath, convulsions, and delirium. Now, I think the delirium was there before they took the cream. Some women try to make themselves lighter so that men can be more attracted to them, said Frank Njinga, a Kenyan psychiatrist and respected social commentator. It's the men who have the idea that white women or light-skinned women are more attractive. Mary Adiambo learned firsthand about the physical problems that can result from complexion lightener. As a dark-skinned teenager, she was envious of her sister's lighter color and was mortified when her friends and relatives made fun of her chocolate complexion. For almost 20 years, she smothered her face and body with a variety of bleaching creams and lotions, trying to obtain the perfect caramel tone. In the beginning, it looked good. She's the mother of four now, children ages 9 to 17. She says, I was happy with my color, and my friends told me I looked beautiful. But gradually, her skin began to thin and burn. Red patches spread. Black lumps appeared all over her stomach. She stopped using the chemicals and broke out in a rash. And then she began to sprout a thick mustache. I could go on, but I'm sure you've been in some of these places and seen the depigmented skin and the skin cancer that comes as the protective melanin no longer protects against ultraviolet. Even in an all-African country, how is it that they can look in the mirror in their own place and see an image that they consider to be defective? That's a process and a function of consciousness. That's where we are losing the battle for the minds and hearts of our people. And of course, we're the country that pioneered Nadnola, Porcelana, and the ads are still flourishing and they're still selling. And for even those who don't go for physical lightening, they go for mental skin lightening. So we have people who are not clear about whether they have a family or not, and even if they have a family, not clear about the value of the family, and there's no way that you can operationalize Pan-Africanism when people can't even accept the individual that they are. We didn't get this way just by accident. But the oppression system that we experience caused the intergenerational socialization process to be destroyed. In other words, you have to be taught to believe whatever it is that you believe. Ordinarily in families, one of the most central responsibilities is control of the intergenerational socialization processes. That's a serious thing that you never leave to strangers, that you never let go by without being taken care of. And so what we have as a consequence of the loss of control over this intergenerational cultural transmission is something that I call identity confusion. I think Baba Cambone had something else. I can't remember what title he gave to it, but it means the same thing. And I've got another title that I give to it. It's called Cultural AIDS. We have a problem of physical AIDS. And they say that with physical AIDS, there's a virus that attacks the immune system, physical immune system. And that immune system becomes less resistant until finally it has no resistance, and then it allows things in that it would ordinarily know to reject because they're dangerous. And the body can no longer protect itself, and ultimately the people die. Cultural AIDS is even more deadly than physical AIDS. There's a cultural virus that can attack the African immune system, a system that ought to screen out certain values, that ought to screen out certain worldviews, because they would be harmful to the structure of the society and to the structure of the socialization process. There ought to be a line in the sand that says, no, we don't go there. But we find our people now with cultural AIDS open to anybody's value system, anybody's suggestion. I see it as I watch these people on television, and it breaks my heart on the Jerry Springer Show and other shows. What breaks my heart is the cardinal rule of the African community is being broken. At least in my community, it was said, don't put your business in the street. And now we got people who are volunteering, and they don't even have to pay them money to put their business in the street. If they don't have business to put in the street, they will make up business that they think will sell to put in the street. And there's no shame anywhere. That's cultural AIDS. And you could talk about many other examples of cultural AIDS. We know the people in the community who have gone over to the other side, who have announced their confusion. I'm not African. I'm certainly not black. I've got so much stuff in me. I've got so many things in me. I'm Cablan Asian. I'm part Indian, part Irish, part this, part that, so I just don't know who I am. That's true. You got AIDS. You got AIDS. The very people that you thought you mixed with were already mixed with you before they got here. We had 800 years of mixing in Europe with Moors up there. In the royal family, we mixed with the best of them. And so the ones that came here from the royal families brought us with them. So I don't know who it is that you mix with, but the confusion is the problem. We have a question of geopolitical understanding. I want to take just a minute with this. We have a problem of geopolitical understanding. That is, we don't quite understand what the rest of the world is up to, especially what they're up to when it comes to us. We don't understand what they're up to, and I phrase that question this way. When Europeans think about themselves, what do they think the urgent matters are for the year 2000? You go back 20 years and you follow this question. I got 9 books that I want to mention to you. The very first one started here in Chicago. So that if we wanted to know what Europe, not what they think about us, but what they fear and therefore what they think about themselves and what is it that they have to do to guarantee the survival of their people. The nice thing about living in America is that people write books about their secrets. You don't have to wait and ask somebody to whisper in your ear. They publish what it is that they think about themselves, and they also publish what they think about you. So let's see what they think about themselves. I know that in 1952, Robert Maynard Hutchins and Mortimer Adler over here at the University of Chicago wrote a book called Great Books of the Western World. Why did they write Great Books of the Western World? Because there had been cultural confusion in the white world about who they were and the value of who they were, so they mobilized a national effort. I remember it in school when the great books came out and the Syntopicon. You remember? That was the index to the great books. And there were great book seminars all over America to re-socialize America into an image of themselves that compared with Greece and Rome. That's what they were after, because they feared the disintegration of European civilization. So they patched it up. And it started right here at the University of Chicago. That's the first of the nine pieces. There are hundreds of these, but some of them are so powerful because they make the point in a very brief but powerful way. In 1991, Daniel Burstein wrote a book called Euroquake. Europe's explosive economic growth will challenge the world. Euroquake. They looked at what was getting ready to happen in the world, and they started making predictions that they could base their plans upon, and they wrote books like these. This is one, Euroquake, published by Simon & Schuster. I'll mention that because a couple of the others are published by Simon & Schuster. Sometimes you have to look at who's publishing things, especially when you get into the several books that I want to mention about us, because they talk about us too. Simon & Schuster, Euroquake. By the way, if you go into the great books of the Western world, you won't find us in it other than the Africans who they didn't know were Africans in the great books of the Western world, because there are some great Western books that were actually written by Africans. And you might not know, unless you read some of Baba Jake's work, that some of those same books that pumped up the self-esteem of Europeans were the books that castigated Africans. They took us down to push themselves up. Montesquieu and all of those others. Hegel and all of those others. So in 1991, they're doing a patch-up job again. In 1992, Joel Kotkin in Los Angeles wrote a book called Tribes, How Race, Religion, and Identity Determine Success in the New Global Economy. Listen to what they're thinking about for themselves. What do they fear? They want the rules for success. And they decided that the rules for success, at least this author did, and in fact, all the authors agree that the same rules, they agree on the same rules. But he just said there's these five global ethnic families that are tied together by a strong sense of ethnic identity that give them trust in each other so that they can mobilize politically and economically. You ought to get the book, because this one in particular says something about you. You're one of the chapters in here. And one of the things they say is you don't get it. They say you don't know what the rule is. You don't know about the ethnic rule. You don't know about the family feeling. You don't know that trust comes from that. And you don't know that your disunity has to do with your self-concept. And so you're not investing energy like they are in determining the great books of the African world, and where the world is going, and what the rule is for getting there. In 1993, Lester Thoreau wrote a book called Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. You'd have to look very hard to find an African book on a topic like that. An African book that's trying to find our space in the year 2080. And is trying to find out what other people are doing so we can weave in and out and establish ourselves and that we can be competitive in the world as a family. But they write those kind of books, Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America, but not Africa. Africa was not mentioned except to say Africa is an economic basket case. If God gave it to you, give it back. Samuel Huntington, in 1996, from Harvard, almost wrote the same book that Kotkin wrote. He wrote a book called The Clash of Civilization and the Remaking of World Order, Simon & Schuster. The Clash of Civilization and Remaking of World Order. So what's the goal? Remaking world order. They want to build another order. What's the order? We're talking about power, who will be in power and who will be the victims of power. That's what they're talking about. How do you get there? What's the rule? Huntington says it's the same rule Kotkin says it was. The rule is family. And so this time he calls family not tribe, but he calls them civilization. There are three major families, ethnic and global, that Huntington talks about. The Asian, the European, and the Islamic. That's where the ball game is being played. Once again, you don't hear any word about the Africans. There is a chapter in this book about Africa. He agreed with Kotkin. You don't get it. So you're not one of the three civilizations that anybody has to worry about. He said, you could be. This guy is one who has actually diagnosed that situation. He said, you got a power center in South Africa, and you got a power center in Nigeria. They could become the anchor states around which the whole African continent could organize, talking about actualizing and making Pan-Africanism come. They saw Pan-Africanism for us, and if they did that, then Africans all over the world could spin off of that structured organization. What's happening in those places? What's happening? What's happening to African consciousness in South Africa? What's happening to anybody that speaks up for African consciousness in South Africa? What happened to a Winnie Mandela, a Steve Biko, in a place called South Africa? ? 90% of the population, and we're trying to beg our way into power even now. Even now. Same people who were in charge are still in charge, basically. Running the police, the army, the banks, the diamonds, the gold. Power shift hadn't taken place. Land hadn't been redistributed and so forth. A little frittering here and there. But these people are conscious. The clash of civilization, remaking of world order, three families that are global with a high sense of ethnic identity. You can't challenge these people and make them believe that they are not a part of the families that they choose to be in. In 1999, Lee Edwards wrote a book called The Power of Ideas, : The Heritage Foundation at 25 Years. What are they talking about? They're talking about the fact that a handful of people got together a little over 25 years ago and made a decision to take over the United States of America's agenda in a think tank called the Heritage Foundation. I want you to listen to me now, because some of what I'm saying now is going to come up in the list of books that I'm talking about us. You know, what do they say about us and what do they do about us? Because some of us and our problem is tied to their agenda, because they see us as disturbing their agenda. You need to know that the Heritage Foundation is funded by the Bradley Foundation. Some of y'all here from Milwaukee, that's where Bradley Foundation is. That's one of the donors to the Heritage Foundation. The Bradley Foundation is the place that sponsored the bell curve. You need to know some of these things. The Bradley Foundation is hooked up with the Olin Foundation. I'll come back to the Olin Foundation in a minute. Coors Foundation sponsors the Heritage Foundation. Scafies, the ones that went after Clinton, helped fund the Heritage Foundation. Well, these people are bragging that they got their agenda going in 1980 and that they have over 80% of it already achieved, which includes things that affect us, like vouchers. That's their program. They thought it up in their think tank. We need to think about that. You know, we need to think about whether, you know, first we got to be clear about what we want. You know, I'm very clear that I want independent African education. But I'm also clear about tricks. I know tricks. There's a history of tricks. When people went to accredit the school, this is when they had another think tank with Thomas Jesse Jones in it, who worked at Hampton University, under Samuel Chapman Armstrong, when they were trying to kill critical thinking in the African community through mishigher education. And they got Thomas Jesse Jones to become an expert on black people and run around to independent black schools and accredit them. And he came away saying that no black school was qualified to function by itself. It needed a white board of trustees. Do you see how the trick can be played? You can have the potential for having independence. But if someone has the rule that they can execute, then the rug may be pulled out from under you, even though you're doing exactly what you want to do. I don't have a problem with the agenda of independence, but I have a problem with the tricks that are played when you're depending on somebody else to give you permission or to give you money. So these people in 1980, they did a lot of things in 1980. You may not know this, but there was a meeting called in 1980 at the Fairmont Hotel. You might want to go get this book if you can still find it. Most of these things don't stay in print long. And the book is called The Fairmont Papers. And in the Fairmont Papers, they had a bunch of Negroes that they invited to the Fairmont Hotel to audition for jobs as Negro leaders. The meeting was chaired by Edwin Meese. In other words, somebody had a meeting before the meeting. And they knew that if they flattered some Negroes and told them they were going to be the new leaders, they could replace the old leadership and they could come out. Well, some of the names of people who were there, you know, Clarence Pendleton was there. Remember him? The civil rights person. Clarence Thomas was there. Did you know that? You thought Clarence Thomas just came up on his own. He auditioned for the job. I'm saying, we may be sitting down thinking things happen accidentally, but there are people who have plans in mind, and these people have bragged that for 25 years they've been in charge of the national agenda. And they sold a whole bunch of stuff. By the way, the man who wrote The Bell Curve also worked at the Heritage Foundation, in addition to being funded by the Bradley Foundation and also at the American Enterprise Institute. In the year 2000, a new book is on the scene called Cultural Amnesia. Listen at it now. Remember, we started in 1952 with the problem identified as cultural amnesia, and they did great books of the Western world. Here's a man now saying, it's gotten weak again. We've forgotten too much information to be a family. It's time to put the patchwork quilt together again. His name, Stephen Bergman, Cultural Amnesia, America's Future, and the Crisis of Memory. Some people get it. Some people understand that a sense of identity is critical and that the socialization process produces a sense of identity and that the sense of identity that comes from the socialization process makes politics and economics possible. Unless you're by yourself in Kaplan Asia. Last week, in the New York Times book review, a book was reviewed called The Global Me, New Cosmopolitanism and the Competitive Edge, Picking Globalism's Winners and Losers. Here's a man that has a geopolitical view of the world that says what we need is a new kind of identity, not African, cosmopolitan, Kablanasian. He says, why? Because we have a global economy, we have global technology, we have global migration, and we have a whole lot of racial mixing. So why don't we just legitimize the product of all of that and call the identity cosmopolitan and build a global unity for economic and political struggle on that basis? This is last Sunday in the paper. You ought to pick that book up and just look at it and see how this is when Europeans think about themselves, what they're saying. What they're saying about the economy, where it's going. What they're saying about identity and where that's going. What they're saying about socialization and where it's going. And what they say about you and where you're going in order for them to go where they need to go. Well, let's take a quick look at what they wrote about us. That's interesting. What they wrote about themselves. That's interesting. You're wondering about number 9. Anybody? Oh, no compulsives in here. See, if I were in another type of cultural group, by now 50 people would have stood up and said, you said 9, you only gave us 8. I just decided to skip Patrick Buchanan's book, The Great Betrayal. How America's sovereignty and social justice are being sacrificed to the gods of the global economy. But at least you know what it was without my commentary. I want to move to this second piece, though. The question of when Europeans think about Africans, what do they say? You heard what they said when they thought about themselves. When they think about Africa, well, in the 1970s, it looked like all this stuff starts in Chicago all the time. In the 1970s, they wrote a book about us. This is not the first book they had written about us. There were others. But in the 1970s, they wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind. That was Alan Bloom. And that was a book, The Closing of the American Mind, that savaged ethnic studies. In other words, they said, the university is not a place for Africans to learn anything about themselves. For Indians to learn it, for Asians to learn it. That's not the place for the university. That waters down the curriculum. That was the thesis of that argument, right out of Chicago here, that book was written. Well, that wouldn't mean anything because most professors write books and nobody reads them. But this book, Simon and Schuster, this book was passed around to university presidents all over America, and most universities in America had workshops on this book. Why? Because in the 60s, Africans had demanded that they have an opportunity to have some books in the library about themselves, that they can get to know themselves so that they like who they see in the mirror and don't need Nat Nola. That's what we had demanded. And then they say, well, for you to learn about yourself deconstructs the image we have of ourselves. We've been saying we started philosophy, and when you learn about yourself and find out you started philosophy, then you will undermine our self-confidence. So you get a hired gun. You always get them from the best universities, University of Chicago, Harvard University, Stanford University, and places like that. This is about us. Look, I wouldn't have to make any kind of speech if you just went back and reread Closing of the American Mind and get the chapter that deals with African curriculum. Just get that chapter and look at it. I mean, it's vicious. It's always more vicious on African people than anybody else. I'll tell you why. You haven't heard anybody mobilize to attack the advances of any other group in self-understanding at the level that the attack has been on African people. Why? Think about that for a moment. Let's just look at the second book. They looked, see, there was a book written about the history of the National Endowment for Humanities by Gilkerson and Sussner some years ago, over 20 years ago, they wrote that book. The History of the National Endowment for Humanities. What happened? A group of scholars from the Association of Learned Societies, Phi Beta Kappa and all those, got together worried that America was losing their cultural position of prestige when compared to France and Germany and England. So they said, we need the government to patch up our self-esteem. Therefore, establish the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts to pump up our image. That's what they did. You thought they just did that so that you could get some grants. try to get a grant to study the African origin of civilization and see what happens to you. If you want to study slave ships, they might let you do that. Might. But look at this. E.D. Hirsch in 1988, cultural literacy. You say, well, that's not about it. Indirectly, it is. Why? Because the gains that have been made in black studies and African studies, the books were just pouring out of these institutions, fundamentally changing paradigm. Lorenzo Turner's book, Africanisms in the Gullah Dialect, we went back to that and got it. Here was an incredible scholar who took on the entire linguist establishment back in the 30s. Said, this way African people talk, the type of language form they have, is in part due to what they brought with them. The language they've been saying, no, it's because your big lips and your big tongue is so thick you can't articulate. That's what they were saying at Stanford. That's what they were saying at Harvard and places like that. So Lorenzo Turner did African scholarship, went to Africa, learned languages, then came back based on the language he learned, then did ethnography in the Gullah Sea Island community. After he had become bonded to the people, he waited until they would trust him enough to tell him things. And then all of a sudden he began to record all these retained African words that the white language had said weren't there. Talking about this is out of Chicago, Lorenzo Turner. This is a seminal piece of work that had been pushed under the rug. Do you know that white linguists in many cases are still arguing the pre-Lorenzo Turner argument? They just did in the Ebonics case out in Oakland. They just did that. They're still making the same argument that this is dumb language. This is poor folks' language. This is street language. This is street speech. That's not academically sound. But then, because we were able to come and unravel the history lies, unravel the political science lies, unravel the psychology lies, then they say, we better patch this thing up again. We say, there's knowledge that will make you literate. So in 1988, E.D. Hirsch and his friends, three white professors at the University of Virginia, got together and decided what the world should know in order to be called literate. That's arrogant, isn't it? To sit down and think that you can just sit down and make that decision on your own. Have you read the book Cultural Literacy? It's worth reading. Count the things that he says every literate person is supposed to know. Over half of the items in the list are about Greek and Roman civilization. You can't be literate unless you know Greece and Rome. That's what he said. Oh, he worked at the Heritage Foundation too. Did you know that? Yeah, that's part of his friend. That's part of his crowd. Murray and Herrnstein, who wrote The Bell Curve, hang out there too. So they had to patch up something about themselves in order to deal with what we began to know about ourselves. But the plot thickens. In 1991, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote a book called The Disuniting of America, Reflections on a Multicultural Society, published first by American Express. Every other page was stamped with American Express. This is a book that was published so fast that the ink was not dry on it, and then it was sent out to the heads of all the major corporations in America. Isn't this an odd thing to do for a new book? What was Schlesinger saying? Well, he had Baba Jake's picture in there, my picture in there, Dr. Clark's picture in there, Ma Alana's picture in there, Wade Noble's picture in there. A rogue's gallery to send out to all of corporate America to say that if you say that you're African, you're disuniting America. Think about that. Now, that's from the left wing. See, I've been talking about the right wing. One thing that the left and right agree upon is that there can't be no Africa. They agree on that. It's just a method of getting rid of the Africans. One might get rid of you by denying you. The other will get rid of you by absorbing you. But you're gone in either case. By the way, Whittle, does that name ring a bell to anybody? It's the man who had Channel 1, where they give the kids computers as long as you make them watch the internet and the ads. I think it's 15 minutes a day. So it's not about education, it's about ads. That's Chris Whittle. I'm talking about him because he's the one that had the Edison Project. Understand what I'm saying? That's being sold, mainly in a lot of places with Title I money, but school districts all over the country are buying socialization from a stranger. See? How are you going to raise your kids to look in the mirror and not want Nat Nola when you turn them over to somebody else? You trusted them more than yourself. Think about that for a minute. Whittle is the one published the book the second time around after American Express published the book for Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And Whittle is found on the left and the right. All he wants to do is make money. Dinesh D'Souza in 1996 wrote a book called The End of Racism. He said, y'all been talking about racism was your problem? I just wrote a book and showed that it does not exist anymore. Well, you already had William Junius Wilson, who had said in his book from the University of Chicago, The Declining Significance of Race. So there's somebody in the background that wants to sell you on the idea that there's no more problem, and the only problem that you can possibly have is of your own selfish, lazy self. Go look in the mirror and get some Nat Nola. In 1997, Mary Leftwich wrote a book, Not Out of Africa, How Afrocentrism Became an Excuse to Teach Myth as History. From the very people that have been teaching myth as history all their lives. In the area of the classics, who have been teaching more myth than that? Schlesinger, who wrote this book, The Disuniting of America, argued, he said it's okay for government to tell a royal lie. He went back to Greece and Rome for that. A royal lie, I mean, an everyday person tells a lie. But if the government needs to tell a lie for its own purposes, that's all right. He called that a royal lie. Now, Mary Leftwich says, this, you know, Egypt is not African, and nothing in Europe is due to anything the African people did. Because these Afrocentrists, notice who's being attacked now. Nobody else has had a book done with a rogues gallery in the book circulated to all the corporate heads as a hit list. It's the Africans who've done it. Or it's the Africans who have been done against. Why? Why would someone do it against the Africans? Martin Bernal told me one time when he wrote his book, Black Athena, which is okay, you know, something. He said, you know what some of my white friends told me? I said, what? He said, they told me, why would you arm them? Why would you arm them? In other words, somebody knew the value of correct history to African people. Adlai Sanford in New York just told me the same thing that somebody, she said, why is it that are all the people in Lynn Jeffrey's curriculum of inclusion in New York City, you remember how the papers came down on that attempt just to get a little space to find out something about ourselves? Why would they pick on the African people and not pick on the other people? You know what the answer that the person gave her was? Said, because the Africans are the ones who can mobilize and get it together. Think about that for a moment. We may not understand the power of the cultural renewal, but they do clearly understand it. So Mary Lefkowitz, a weak Greek scholar, Obinga says he didn't think that she knew Greek, let alone Kemetic. And Obinga can say that because he's fluent in Greek. He said, this woman's not making any sense. Not only that, she's never read any Kemetic text. She's just making pronouncements. That's one of the things about Schlesinger's book, Dinesh D'Souza's book. They look like they were written by a computer. Just pull facts from here and there. Literally looks like a computer.